Well, what can we learn from those ancients who were believers? And how does that affect us today? We'll talk with James about that, and we'll take your calls next. James Wasserman with us. His latest work is called Templar Heresy, A Story of Gnostic Illumination on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, James Wasserman with us. James, how can we learn from what happened during this period? And what period are we talking about? 1400s, 15, 17?
No, we're talking a bit earlier. The Crusades were launched in 1095, and Europe was defeated in 1291.
Wow, that is way gone back.
Yeah, it's going back.
What lessons would we learn today from what happened to them?
Well, there's a lot of different parts of it. You know, one thing is, and I think we're learning this only too well, it's very difficult to conduct a military campaign so far from your own country, your own base. You know, the Europeans fought in the Holy Land for almost 200 years and were defeated. It was extremely expensive. There was a great deal of trouble surrounding it, and over time, people became more and more angry, frustrated, and upset, and hopeless over the ongoing battle. Some of the other things I think we could do is maybe begin to question what it is that causes us to go to war. You know, sometimes we are really...
Greed.
Yeah. Greed is one thing, but a kind of intolerance is another. You know, it's anger and frustration. One of the things they were trying to do, oddly enough, was kind of get rid of young men who were running around Europe fighting with each other constantly. You know, the knights were often kind of like ruffians, thugs, almost street gangs. One noble would have a street gang on his side, and the other noble would have a street gang working for him, and they would be battling each other and killing people and destroying property in the process. And, you know, the popes and some of the other religious leaders are saying, what the hell are we going to do with these people? And they say, I have a great idea. Let's send them to, Jerusalem and have them fight, you know, a real enemy. So there's kind of that, too.
What does that tell you about this planet, James, because it seems like that's all we do is war and fight and kill?
Well, we also love and learn and make friends and have conversations. And, you know, you and I don't know each other, but this is, you know, like over the number of hours that we've spent talking, I've come to really like you as a human being and listen to you and learn from you. That's the other thing that we do as people. You know, we love. And I think, you know, it's the balance. We're an imperfect species, so to speak. Or maybe we're a perfect species who's just very violent. I don't really know.
Yeah.
That's up to God to decide.
Are there more of us who love or more of us who hate?
Probably it's about equal, wouldn't you think?
Sadly, yeah.
Yeah. That's that whole dualism concept, you know, the Manichaean light and darkness balanced perfectly on either side.
So true. Let's go take some calls here for you, all right?
You got it.
Joe in the Bronx, welcome. Joe's not ready, but Keith in Rochester, New York is. Go ahead, Keith.
Are you talking about the Knights Templar as a truly spiritual organization, even to the point of them being monastic insofar as them being pure, which is probably the key reason why they were not able to stay together? My question has to do with true modernity, where, as Mr. Norrie just referenced, people today are much less spiritual in this politically correct world. It's frowned upon. How do you think in the future that what I'm calling a would-be Knights Templar would get off the ground when so many people today are not rooted in true spiritualism, that this idea of the warrior monk, which I personally ID with, were ostracized to the point that they don't want to know us. And I really feel that people today are different from past ages, whether there's, to say it bluntly, less testosterone in men, that they just will not stand up and be true men of good manhood. I'm really fearful of the future, as you were stating, that we will not get our act together, and that because we are so at odds with each other, that we stay off to our sides, and people will not interact with people that they feel do not agree with them. This is very ominous, and I'm asking really for all of us, even though I'm doing it manly, I'm really beseeching that we are going to have to reach out together. We are sadly doomed, and I do not see any light at the end of that proverbial tunnel, and it just goes on and on, and I really fear for the future in all of us.
Well, I do too. I really do. But on the other hand, you know, I have hope, and maybe that's really, maybe hope is the last refuge of a scoundrel as opposed to patriotism. I don't know. I look at some of the things I see, you know, I look at kids, I watch them play, you know, there you really know boys will be boys and girls will be girls. And, you know, we are composed of, you know, a genetic stream that goes back for millennia. And frankly, all of the politically correct hatred of human beings can only fail, I think, because they are the ones who are denying nature, and nature is stronger than ideology.
What would happen today, James, if the Knight Templars were around? What would they be doing?
I hope that what they would be doing is talking about spirituality, talking about honor, talking about loyalty, talking about the values that have strengthened us as a species for our entire time on Earth. I would hope they'd be talking about God, and they'd be talking about practices like meditation and yoga, by which one can approach God and approach a greater understanding. I believe the Templar tradition is very much alive on Earth. I believe I, too, am part of it. And when you're talking about the kind of tolerance that you have for the variety of different guests that you bring on to this show, and the views that you allow them to express openly in a search for truth, I think you are too, George.
Next up, we go to John in Palm Harbor, Florida. Hey, John, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Hello, George. I was so glad to hear your guest on this evening.
Oh, great.
I wanted to make a comment. My great-grandfather was very good friends with Aleister Crowley, and he was a very insight. I have several things he left me, including some artifacts that Crowley brought back from Egypt. And he knew him so well that he was one of the people that helped him to try and get into a higher order of Freemasonry. But what he said, he had a very interesting insight on Aleister Crowley. He said the man could command a room. When he came in, he was the center of attention. He could analyze the whole situation and know what to do and know how to get people's attention, but he had a duality about him.
Right.
Where he could have been such a great person. He had the right ideas and concepts and empathy, but as he grew further in his attention and people, you know, his influence, it went to his head. And he ended up, we know about his shortcomings and the things that he did that were, you know, immoral. We know about some of the things he tried to do that were good for communities. But he went on about this duality. And that's my question for you. Will a leader rise up that has the duality of someone as a Hitler or as a Christ that could potentially change in a moment the direction that we're going as far as the wars that we're having? And is it possible that Donald Trump may have seen things, being a rich man, a billionaire, but has the empathy to understand things that the poor man does and can put a stop to this, could possibly get us out of this mess that we're in? And that's my question for you.
Well, my answer is that I hope so, but on the other hand, I'm not looking for leaders. What I'm looking for is for people to become our own leaders. Now, I'm very happy at President Trump. I voted for him, and I'm delighted by much of what he's doing. But I don't need him to tell me what's right. And I really believe that we all need to rise to the occasion, become those kind of spiritual billionaires that we all are on the inside, and bring our truth to this world to help people who are chosen as our leaders.
How would the Knight Templars of then reacted with the Vatican today? Would they, James?
Now that's a wicked question.
I know it. That would be an interesting thing to see, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I'd hate to be today's Pope, standing before some of those warriors and talking about the kind of bizarre tolerance that he preaches.
Oh my God! This Pope's under fire by some of his own clergy.
Well, as well he should be. They have one of the largest fences, in the world around the Vatican, and all he's talking about is tearing down our barriers. Why doesn't he put his money where his mouth is, so to speak?
Let's go to Jim, driving in Arkansas, first-time caller. Jim, thank you for calling, and you are on the air with us.
Well, good morning, sirs. Thank you for having me on.
Sure thing, Jimmy.
I was just curious, in your research, have you found any actual historical linking between the Knights Templar and modern-day Freemasonry?
Good question. What do you think, Jim?
I think that there is undoubtedly a linkage, yes. I don't know that there's a charter from a Knight Templar saying to, Joe Blow in Scotland that I am inducting you into the Holy Order, at least a signed charter that could pass muster by a document expert. But it is so clear to me, by looking at Freemasonry and looking at the Templars and looking at the history, that when the French king attacked the Templars in 1307, many of them fled from all parts of Europe, and we know that they were welcomed in Scotland by Robert Bruce, who had been excommunicated by the Pope, so he had absolutely no allegiance to the Pope, and he was at war with the English king, so that he needed armed, experienced warriors. And I believe that that is the birthplace of Freemasonry, from very much from that influence.
How about Paul in Seattle now, west of the Rockies? Go ahead, Paul.
Well, thanks for taking my call, George.
You're welcome.
I'll tell you one thing those Templars would be doing if they were here today. They'd be carrying some Glock 9s, I tell you that.
Oh, yeah.
But anyway, but seriously, I might be getting something confused here, but I thought I saw something. And do you know anything about a knight named Arturo who they based the King Arthur off of the Round Table and all that?
Arturo.
Well, Arthur was, if I'm not mistaken, he was considered to be a king from those days. I don't know the name Arturo, but I think that he was one of the local English kings in a small group of people. So that's my understanding of who that character is.
And I think Arthur developed, wasn't the myth he pulled a sword out of the rock and things like that?
Well, sure, and he was, that whole myth cycle began to surface around the time of the Crusades. The entire Grail tradition is an offshoot of the Templar and the Crusade tradition. you know, Wolfram von Eschenbach, who wrote Parzival, spoke about the Grail being guarded by the Knights Templars at Mont Sauvage. So this is definitely something that has mythologically been going on. You know, all of that data came in at the same time, at the time of the Crusades.
Who created the Knights Templar, James?
Well, they created themselves to some extent. They volunteered to guard pilgrims, and, you know, they sought to take monastic order, monastic consecration. But it was St. Bernard of Clairvaux who, 10 years after they were actually founded, spread their legend and built the conceptual basis of the order. He had them approved as an official body of the Catholic Church. He wrote a rule for them that was based on the rule of St. Benedict in the 4th century. He popularized them by extensive traveling throughout Europe at the time, and he wrote an extremely important letter to them, which was well-publicized. It's in my book, The Templars and the Assassins, and it speaks of the concept of the holy warrior and the warrior of God. So St. Bernard of Clairvaux was really important in this story.
All right, we're going to come back in just a moment with James Wasserman, our final segment with your final phone calls, the book we're talking about tonight. And he has written many, by the way, including The Secrets of Solomon, The Egyptian Book of the Dead, Templar Heresy, A Story of Gnostic Illumination, and his website, of course, is his name, JamesWassermanBooks.com, linked up at CoastToCoastAM.com. Back in a moment with your final calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. James Wasserman with us. His book is called Templar Heresy, and we'll get final calls as well. James, who was it that tried to eradicate the Knights Templar?
It was King Philip IV in collusion with Pope Clement V.
And it happened like on a Halloween, right, or something like that?
It was Friday the 13th.
Uh-huh.
That was the day of the arrest, and that's how that day became associated with bad luck. You know, one of the things I wanted to mention, that we asked about lessons that we can learn.
Yes.
The king and the pope started a smear campaign with their version of the deep state and the media against the Templars that took down a group of heroes who had been very popular in European society for 200 years. For all of the faults that they may have had, they were courageous people and they had battled in the cause of Christianity for a long time. They were smeared in such a way that they were then taken out and killed, burned at the stake, and people did not rise up against the king because the lies and the fake news and the media campaign had just destroyed them. So that's one of the other lessons
interesting
we need to learn.
They used their own little form of social media, huh?
You're not kidding, George.
Interesting take. Back to the calls, final calls. Joe in the Bronx in New York. Hi, Joe.
Hey, George. How are you, George?
Great, Joe. Thanks.
Good, good. Yeah, I wanted to ask Mr. Wasserman, you mentioned some of the first-level relics like the Spear of Destiny and the Fragment of the True Cross. Now, where did the story, and I understand that the Nazis may have gained possession of the Spear of Destiny during World War II, and then it was later liberated by the Allies or the Americans. Where did the story of the Spear of Destiny, its power, that he who possesses the Spear of Destiny will rule the world, where did that originate?
Well, I think it originated in, you know, kind of the popular imagination from the time of you know, shortly after the death of Christ. I mean, I really think it was something that the Nazis bought into, but mm-hmm. the Crusaders, you know, spoke of that. It was one of the most important relics that Christianity possessed. How it became identified as the key to worldly power, that I'm not so sure. There's a great book on it by Trevor Ravenscroft called The Spirit of Destiny. And if you're looking for something good to look at, you might try that.
Hitler was big into the occult, was he not?
Well, yes. From all indications, he definitely believed in these powers and forces, and it's quite clear to me, at least, watching him speak, that he was almost possessed by supernatural beings
right.
who were working through him.
Was he looking for the Ark of the Covenant?
I think he was looking for anything he could find to gain power, George. And I think that he was a lunatic. And yeah, I bet you he was looking for that. We know he was looking for the Grail. There are a lot of expeditions. He had expeditions going to Tibet to try to seek out, you know, keys to power. It was a sick power, though. It's not the power we're talking about here with narcissism. It was not the power to know God. It was the power to rule men. Very different.
You felt that the Crusades were important. How come?
I think it was the opening of the Renaissance. I think that the Dark Ages that had been going on in Europe from the 6th century up to the 10th century had really created a situation of superstition, darkness, political conditions akin to slavery and everything else. And I think once Europe opened up and went and traveled and learned and saw some of the wisdom of the East, the Muslims at the time of the Crusades were a far more advanced civilization than Europe. Things have turned around nowadays, and it's almost an exact reversal of what existed then. But the contact with the Muslim world opened the eyes of Europe, and the mystery tradition, which had been lost to the West, was reintroduced as a result of the Crusades.
We have Doug in Topeka, Kansas now. Douglas, go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, I'm still here.
Okay, Doug.
Yeah, I just wanted to bring up that in recent history, the Templars have risen back up. It's a group called the Knight Templar International.
Were they based out of, do you know?
I think their main headquarters is in the Czech Republic. They've got a headquarters in Great Britain also.
Do you know if they're associated with the original Knights Templars?
Well, from what I've seen on their website, they draw their heritage from them. But the modern version seems to spring out from the Reformation or whatever of it by one of the, I think it's Benedict, Pope Benedict, the recent one.
All right. Let me check with you, James. Could this be a resurrection of the Knights Templar?
You know, they have people have been claiming to be a resurrection of the Knights Templar since the 14th century, and I think it would be great if people came up and sought after the truths and showed the virtues of courage and determination that the Templars embodied, but the Templars themselves were ended by the Pope in 1312. They were disbanded. They are no longer a body within the Catholic Church. So the Knights Templars, in reality, are done.
And what did all those people who were Knights Templars, what did they do?
The ones who survived, in which the majority, many, many thousands, joined other military or monastic orders. Some of them were pensioned, actually, and allowed to stay on Templar property. Others of them abandoned their vows and became farmers and the knights, I guess, could return to some form of property if it's still within their family. They incorporated themselves within medieval society of the day without their order.
They didn't penalize them, though, did they?
Well,
and punish them
aside from the ones that were tortured and burned at the stake.
Yeah, I guess they punished them.
Yeah, those guys were punished. But the other ones eventually got off rather peaceably.
Our founding fathers, most of them were Freemasons. Is that unusual?
Well, I think it's unusual in the sense that America is the freest country on earth, and it was designed by a large number of people who held to Enlightenment values that came from, in my opinion, the interaction during the Crusades with the Knights Templar. So, yeah, it's unusual.
Huh.
And it's wonderful. It's a blessing. It's something that we dare not throw in the toilet with our modern world.
Michael in Amarillo, Texas. Welcome to the program, Michael.
How you doing, George? It's great to be on the show.
Great.
Once again. Great show as always. I don't think you realize how many of us truck drivers you keep up at night.
Well, that's good.
Anyway, I just want to ask your guest tonight, have you ever heard of, there is a video game called Assassin's Creed, and I just want to know if your guest has ever heard of that. I mean, it covers 1,000 years.
Interesting tech. Have you heard of a video called that?
Yeah, there's a video game called that. There's also some silly comic book series that runs along those lines. They certainly incorporate some of the myth of the real assassins, but I think you'll learn more about the assassins in my novel and my book, The Templars and the Assassins, than you will from the video game.
And I'm going to assume that the word assassin that we all know as someone who will kill someone for hire originated, I guess, from them, right?
Yes, it's actually, it comes, they were accused of smoking hashish, so they were called hashashim, and that is apparently the linguistic derivation of our word assassin.
Mary in Dolores, Colorado is with us now. Go ahead, Mayor.
Hello, yes.
Hi there.
One of the causes of population pressure is, I mean, of war is population pressure. Young men of ISIS and Al-Qaeda are coming from countries that are having huge exponential population growth, and these young men have no jobs and
no hope.
That's right.
No hope, no career, nothing.
And people like each other better when they're not crowded. There have been, of course, you've heard of this, the studies done of rats who are caged and given all the food they could eat, and they grow. The population grows and they turn on each other.
They eat each other, yeah.
And, you know, there's an old cowboy verse, one of which, the last line of which runs, I like my fellow man the best when you scattered some.
Almost like neighbors.
Yeah, and so I think withholding contraceptive funds from third world countries is a great mistake.
All right. James, where's that all headed?
Well, I think people need to be responsible and build economies that will sustain their populations. And I think the best way to do that is through the free exchange of goods and services known as capitalism. And I think...
And knowledge, yep.
Knowledge, yeah, freedom. Freedom. That's... open trading and open exchange of goods, skills, and services.
Michael, first-time caller in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Michael.
Mr. Wasserman, all evening I did not hear you mention the Holy Land by its real name of Palestine. Why is that?
Well, I mean, it depends what you mean by real name. In the Bible, it's called Israel. It can be called Palestine. It's called whatever you want, as long as we know what it is. And what it is the Holy Land. And you know, it's the land that God gave to the Jews, and, you know, it's been a seed of a great deal of, you know, belief structure and enlightenment ever since.
Gosh, I wish they'd get that situation resolved, James.
Oh, yeah, well, maybe Jared Kushner can do it in his spare time.
I'm not sure. I'm not sure, but it sure would make a lot of world ills go away, would it not?
That's the truth.
I even think maybe they should carve out part of Iraq or something and give it to the Palestinians and let them have a homeland, something.
that be a bright idea?
Yep. Let's go to Andy in Toronto, Canada. Hi, Andy. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how you doing, George? I haven't called in a while.
Thank you, Andy.
But my favorite topic's come up, and it's impinging upon Catholicism again. I just wanted to ask your guest here. I'm joining it very late, this conversation, because I wasn't up earlier on. But I was just wondering if he is aware of there's something that he said there about, I think he used the word collusion, maybe he didn't, about the King of France, Philip, and Pope Clement being together on this. And I was just wondering if he was familiar with Pierce Paul Reed. And he wrote a book about 20 years ago on the Templars. And too much of our history on this has been sort of influenced by Edward Gibbon and of course, his ethnic nationalism that sort of smears this whole thing. But my point here is he aware that Clement V had not been consulted by the king, and he wrote a letter to him? I believe it's in Paul Pierre Reed's book.
Was he upset? He must have been.
Absolutely. He was upset, and he said he had, you know, I could actually read part of it to you. It's not very long.
Real short. Go ahead.
You, our dear son, have in our absence violated every rule, meaning the King of France, and laid hands on the persons and properties of the Templars. You have also imprisoned them. What pains us even more, you have not treated them with due leniency and have added to the discomfort of imprisonment yet another affliction. You have laid hands on persons and property that are under the direct protection of the Roman Church. Your hasty act is seen by all, and rightly so, as an act of contempt towards ourselves and the Roman Church. So, you know, I wanted to ask him about that.
Can you imagine when he got that letter, what he must have done?
What he did was he badgered the Pope. Pierce Paul Reed's book is excellent, by the way. I appreciate the caller mentioning it. But what he did was Pope Clement jumped on the bandwagon so fast. It's a good thing you weren't standing in his way, because he became a complete ally of the king. He delayed the destruction of the order by a few years. That's true. But the Templars in France were rounded up and imprisoned through the Inquisition, which was the arm of the church under the authority of the Pope, and the king was a military arm of the Inquisition. That part is true. There is no doubt that those two leaders were in collusion, although, like you say, the Pope came into it a month later.
He sure did. James, thanks again. The book, Templar Heresy, well thought out, my friend. Lots going on tomorrow. And don't forget, for you insiders, our chat at 8 o'clock Pacific time. Make sure you're there. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasaur, Stephanie Smith, Chris Borelson, George Knapp, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.